your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Robin. Welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Wednesday night, June 25th, 2025, as we record this new episode. The Chicago White Sox won on Wednesday by a score of 7-3 to salvage one win against Arizona at home. It was a rather bleak first two games, getting blown out 10-0 and then losing 4-1 on Tuesday night. Making matters worse, a White Sox fan has been banned from all Major League Baseball stadiums for heckling Ketel Marte about the death of his mother. Not a great look, but the White Sox made a very nice gesture on Wednesday during the game to show that they have Marte's back. So losing 2 out of 3 puts the White Sox at 26-55 on the season, as we have reached the halfway point of 2025. Double the numbers, and the White Sox are on a pace to finish 52-110, which is an 11-game improvement from last year. For interested parties, the White Sox are on pace to score 560 runs, which would cost me a steak dinner bet. But last year, the White Sox were 21-60 at the halfway point, and didn't play better in the second half as they went 20-61. If you recall, the 2024 White Sox went 7-44 from July 1st to August 30th. Let's not do that again. White Sox general manager Chris Getz met with the media earlier this week to share his first half observations, starting with his own evaluation how things have fared in the first 81 games.
Going into the year, you know, the focus wasn't just primarily on the record, because we knew that, you know, there's so many things that go into improving this organization long term, and that's certainly what we're set out to do. You know, if you look around the field and some of these young players stepping up and developing, Miguel Vargas has continued to get better and is becoming an impactful bat at the major league level, which is great for us, great for the future. Chase Mydroth stepping up. You know, his first season, new organization, to do what he's been doing on both sides of the ball. You know, you look at our chase rates, our walk percentage. You look at some of what our young starters are doing, the development of Shane Smith. You know, Grant Taylor, you know, taking the mound like he did last night and you know, really shutting the door. You know, there's a lot of things to highlight. Obviously, there are other areas that need to be continued to develop and worked on, and you know, we're focused on doing that. So we had objectives coming in that we really wanted to focus on with our major league staff, and they've done a pretty good job in executing that. But we know that there's more that needs to happen for us to really turn the corner and accelerate some things. So overall, feel pretty good about things. Obviously, when you look at a record like we have, you know, you're not too happy about it by any stretch, but there are some positives that we can hang our hat on and continue to move forward.
A big bright spot for the White Sox is how much they are getting back from the Garrett Crochet trade. Chase Mydroth has been worth 1.1 WAR, according to Fangraphs. Kyle Teal's already on the Major League Club, and Winkelmann Gonzalez has joined the bullpen. So far, Getz is happy about the return he's getting.
Very happy with how those players have performed. You know, obviously, you've got Brayden Montgomery in the minor leagues doing a nice job in A-ball right now. And, you know, we can point to Kyle Teal and what he's done at AAA. And, you know, he's getting settled here at the major league level. I love the way he's been catching. You know, the whether it be the game calling, the framing, the catch and throw, he made a great play yesterday with that throw home, that short hop that he handed with such ease and grace, just kind of speaking to his athleticism, and just to have a left-handed hitting catcher. Those are hard to find, so we're certainly excited about having that skill set. Chase, you know, has been solid, and now we've got Winkelmann up here, and you know, he's going to get a chance to show us what he's capable of doing. So feel really good. You look, once again, you kind of go back to where we were going in 2024 with Garrett Crochet and kind of the unknowns, whether he was going to be able to start or not. And now you look at, you know, where we are today and been able to, you know, convert Garrett Crochet to multiple players that can help us. We feel like we're in a much better place.
One sore spot is the lack of production the White Sox are getting from Luis Robert Jr., who left Wednesday's game with an injury. Robert has been replacement level for the White Sox in 2025, His batting average is 185. His on-base percentage is 270. And he's slugging 313 with just 8 home runs in 72 games. It's such poor production that Getz is now contemplating the possibility of holding on to Robert if they can't get a good enough return to meet their asking price.
When you still watch Louis Robert play, you're looking at a guy that, can change the game pretty quickly in a lot of different ways. And those types of players are hard to find. You know, and that's the reason why there's a lot of attention on Louis Robert, because he's earned that right, because he's performed at a high level, and to find talent like that is not easy. So, you know, obviously he's been more productive in the past, but that doesn't mean that we don't believe in the potential here with the Chicago White Sox. We've never out there making phone calls on you know, about Louis Robert. It's teams calling us, and we have conversations, and we kind of stick to the plan that we've been working by, you know, so far, in which if we feel like we can help the long-term health of the organization, so be it. But we like having Louis Robert, and I enjoy having him in the lineup on a nightly basis.
Another growing concern for the White Sox is pitching injuries. Davis Martin and Jonathan Cannon are still in the mend, which leaves the White Sox with a four-man rotation in Shane Smith, Sean Burke, Aaron Civale, and Adrian Hauser. But Smith and Burke will be pushing career highs in innings pitched this season, and Getz admitted the White Sox are already thinking about how to handle inning limits.
We've got to stay on top of how the players how the pitchers are responding to, you know, start to start. You know, obviously you measure the workload, you just look at the innings, but you look at the quality of the pitch, you look at the biomechanics of the pitcher, you take feedback from the pitcher, and you know, those were really motivating factors in us bringing in an Adrian Hauser, making a trade for Civale for us to be comfortably give those guys a break when it's needed. Obviously, you don't want it to be for significant reasons like an IL stint or of serious nature. It's more give these guys a breather. You would skip a start, give them an extra day's rest, and feel like we're still being competitive in doing so. So, you know, it's something we're continually measuring. We know, you know, as we navigate the season, we're probably going to have to get creative with some things. We've proven, you know, a willingness and openness to get creative with a Garrett Crochet situation like we did last year. And, you know, that might apply to some of the arms that we have here.
In our previous episode, we talk about the White Sox trade board, and Getz believes the White Sox will be busy next month.
Yeah, fairly active. You know, we've got some players that have already garnered attention, and you know, if it makes sense for us to make a move that to help us for the long term, then we're going to consider that. But in the meantime, I just want our players to go out there and play. You know, we're coming off of a really nice series in Toronto, especially after those two tough losses with St. Louis. But for guys to bounce back like they did, you know, speaks to their ability to, you know, rinse off some tough games and get back out there and play better baseball. So, you know, we still have plenty of time until the deadline. You know, I have received, you know, inquiries on some of our players. I will say that the draft is the priority right now. We're a couple weeks out, and most teams are doing the same. So, you know, we're going to make sure we're as organized and prepared as possible for the draft. And then once we close the door on the draft, we'll focus more on the trade deadline.
Finally, there's still much development work to be done as more new faces will join the organization. Despite not achieving much success in terms of wins and losses, Getz is still trying to keep the White Sox on the long-term plan.
We feel like if there's talent out there that we feel like can really help us, then we'll go out and do that. But in the meantime, you know, it's been a foundational approach. We're sticking to what it takes to, you know, improve all areas of the organizations and not just relying on free agent spending. That time will come without question. So, you know, we're much more focused on developing the crew that we have up here and developing players in the minor leagues.
A Sox Machine public service announcement. We have brand new items in the Sox Machine store. With the weather heating up, we've got new Adidas Sox Machine polos, perfect for your company outings, casual Fridays, and of course the golf course. It's part of our media attire as well when covering events. You can grab any of these three styles that we now have in the store. We've got new Sox Machine coffee mugs to sip from while you read Jim and James in the morning, new stainless steel water bottles with the Sox Machine logo, and fanny packs, which fanny packs have been very helpful entering Major League Baseball stadiums with all the bag restrictions. Visit shop.socksmachine.com to check out the new gear. And for Socks Machine subscribers, remember your discount code to get an additional discount when checking out. Again, the URL is shop.socksmachine.com. Joining me to recap the White Sox first half and give our grades for their performances and also preview the upcoming San Francisco Giants series at home this weekend is Sox Machine's beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And hello, Jim and James. We just heard from White Sox general manager Chris Getz and his thoughts on how the first half of the 2025 season has gone. But as I also mentioned in the intro, it was very close records last year, Jim. At the first half, at the 81 game mark, the White Sox were 21-60 last year. They ended up going 20-61 in the second half. I forgot how brutal July and August was last year, where they went 7-44 in a 51 game stretch.
When you write the month in a box, you remember a lot that you might have forgotten the first time.
Yeah. So I had to remind myself, hopefully we don't go through that again. But I do wonder, with the White Sox winning 26 games in the first half and knowing what is coming with the trade deadline and a lot more exchanging of new faces joining the organization and uncertainty on how this roster will be for the final 81 games. Jim, have we witnessed more wins in the first half of 2025 than the White Sox will have in the second half of this season?
I'm going to say no. I think that they can win more games in the second half just because, I think a big one is Luis Robert Jr. isn't hitting. If he were, say, like the Garrett Crochet figure in that, like, oh, he's providing all-star caliber production, and now you're talking about trading him, that would have been a blow. Like losing Eric Fetty was a blow. Eric Fetty, I think he led the team in wins, even though he wasn't around for like the final 2+ months. And you had Crochet limited to 4 innings because they were just preserving his trade value. And then you losing Michael Kopech, who looked like he was finally emerging as the high leverage guy they thought he was, and Tommy Pham, who was at least capable of helping to lengthen the lineup. Like those were direct blows to their production that they were getting, and they didn't have any way to compensate for that. So this time around, if Robert's traded, like he's not really hitting, he's not really providing much except for decent defense, but Michael A. Taylor's around to do that if need be. So like, I guess, they lose a bit of upside. But it's been, 3 months and that upside hasn't materialized. So you can't keep counting on that. You don't think any, pitchers are going to be dealt aside from, maybe Adrian Hauser, and we'll see how long that lasts. But like still, like they, that's not something they're counting on. And then the bullpen should be better this time around, especially if Grant Taylor is now in the mix and getting high leverage appearances and looking every bit as good as like his double-A stuff thought he might look. Like that's a weapon they didn't have last year. So I go back to the run differential last year at the 81 game mark. They were 168 runs in the red. When you look at the games they squandered earlier this year, a better bullpen would have solved some of that. So I think they can stumble into, 25 wins into the second half. And that's not a lot. That's sad that that's an improvement, but still it's just, that's what it feels like.
No, I agree with you. I think they'll win more games the second half this year than last year. But have they won more games in the first half season at 26 than they will in the second half?
No, I was looking at last year's standing. So yeah, like 30, I was thinking 5 more wins than what they had in the first half. So yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking.
Okay, so you're still thinking they could be 55, 56 wins at the end of the year.
Yeah, as sad as that sounds.
James, how about you? You were part of that media scrum listening to Chris Getz. He seems really confident that he's going to be busy post MLB draft heading to the trade deadline as far as making some moves. Do you think we've witnessed more wins in the first half of this season than we will see at the second half of this year?
I think they can replicate what they've done. I imagine this is more of an over under structure. deciding to be optimistic more than I intended to about the White Sox has burned me, I don't know, something around 93 times in a row. So I'm reticent, even as I feel myself gearing up for it one more time. I do think they could trade as many as two starting pitchers. Certainly Hauser and Savali, like you could see them leaving. I think Martin getting hurt on top of just how many years of control he has left. And I think they probably Martin stands pat probably. But you're as Jim was pointing out, like you're not losing, like you're clearing away most talented pitchers. Like, Hauser's been like the best, producer or performer, I guess, at this point in terms of rate. But it's not like you don't think like Jonathan Cannon could never put together a stretch that Adrian Hauser is, or even or Martin or even Burke. I think like just because he doesn't blow them away from like a stuff standpoint. A lot of the things that you might lose offensively, one, it kind of strains a little bit to really expect Benintendi to leave just because it's still it's a weird profile to get someone to eat that much money and work out that many years. He's much more like I think rental bat territory, what he's become as a player. And with Robert and Vaughn, who was kind of the other big like piece you're expecting to lose mid-season, you wouldn't expect to have any drop off offensively, if not get better as a result. And watching today, Kyle Teal could be pretty good in the second half. That wouldn't be a crazy thing. Certainly better than he's been so far. You haven't really seen his power come out. You obviously haven't seen any Edgar Caro power come out to a degree that makes you wonder if you're going to see it this year. But it wouldn't be hard to imagine him slugging more than like 315 in the second half either. Like they don't have necessarily clear top 20 prospect stud bats, but they and Chase Meidrov certainly going through what you're wondering, like, is this regression or is just a cold streak and he's gonna come back with a vengeance a little bit in a couple of weeks. But I think you have enough of those guys sprinkled around to think like you could see better versions of them just because they're young players and developing over the course of the second half. And certainly like they didn't have any sort of trick they could pull out, like two Grant Taylor relief innings to salt away a lead in the first half. And that's useful. Wickham and Gonzalez, while still uneven, is someone you could see getting better and being a more useful bullpen piece as the season goes along. It's kind of getting dry as far as like reinforcements of the minors you're really optimistic about. Like, be great if like Brooks Baldwin came up and out hit Luis Robert while playing passable center field, but that's a lot of ifs and maybes to get to
Yeah.
that point. I just think like they're not losing like clearly like far and away their best talent on the team unless you're counting Robert, in which case they haven't really enjoyed productivity anyway. And I think you can see enough growth happening where I want to say like, yeah, put them down for 26 more and call it a season where Will Venable wins manager of the year for 11 game ball or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to call a push because I
Okay.
don't want to be hurt again.
So we got Jim over, we got James at push. I'm gonna go under. I think we've seen more wins in the first half than we will in the second half. And I'm looking at this August schedule. Eesh. Even though there's quite a few home games, there's a lot of road games in September, and the White Sox have just not been a very good road team this season. I think they're only on pace to win 18 road games. It's a part of the schedule. I am really concerned about the pitching as far as how it will hold up. We'll give our pitching grades in a moment, but I'm gonna take the under, which for some of you who have wagered a lot of money on over 49 and a half wins, I think you're going to be sweating entering that final road trip of the season when the White Sox travel to Yankee Stadium to face the Yankees. And then end the season in Washington, D.C. So we'll see how it works up. But right now, I'm thinking the White Sox will only win 24 games in the second half. So I still think that they could get to 50 wins. They're halfway there, or a little more than halfway right now. But I do think we've seen more wins in the first half than in the second half.
Yeah, I think like
What?
Talkman is like the hard guy to get a beat on in terms of,
he's got to be healthy, right?
Yeah, how difficult he is to replace, because like the production's been great when he's been in the lineup. Yes. But he's only played 30 games, so
right.
You know, when losing him, what does that mean when he hasn't been around for more than half of it? But he's looked very good, you know, when he's been in the lineup, and really helps like have a top half lineup when it's Talkman and Mydroth and Vargas. You feel pretty good about that. But like if Talkman's out, it gets pretty shallow pretty quickly.
What is the White Sox record when Mike Talkman plays?
30-0, I believe.
Is it? That is amazing. 30-0. Who would have guessed?
We'll just talk about it more.
8-21. The White Sox are 8-21 this year.
8-18 in the starts. So yeah. Yeah.
So it's today his 30th game, because wouldn't that make them 9-21?
Correct.
Oh, there you go. 9-21. So
yeah, you're shaving wins off of his record.
Sorry, Mike.
30-0.
Sorry, Mike. James was only off by 21 games.
Outfielder wins is a real stat.
I was just curious on how old. It seems like the White Sox play a lot better when Talkman's in the lineup, but 9-21's not a great record. But I think it's still a better winning percentage than the White Sox still have.
9-19 in games where he does not get hurt trying to score the tying run.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. The fact that it's happened twice this year. So with Mike Talkman being brought up, let's talk about the White Sox offense and give our first half grade. And James, on the bright side, and this is something we heard in the intro from Chris Getz, being happy about the early return to the Garrett Crochet trade because of how well Chase Mydroth has played. And in some ways, surprised the White Sox front office with his ability. Miguel Vargas has taken a step forward, especially since mid-April, to help out with the White Sox offense. I know we keep bringing this point up, but it seems like when you're building right now for the 2026 roster, can we write in pen Miguel Vargas and Chase Mydroth for the White Sox, that they can count on these two to help out secure starting spots in the position player side?
I think they would be strongly in the mix. Certainly. I mean, certainly Vargas looks a little bit more solidified than Mydroff at the moment, but yeah, I would expect them to be starters next opening day. Mydroff less because like he's got a position like with a bullet, like he's our second baseman for 10 years sort of statement behind him, and more just like he's been solid and the people who are supposed to overtake him have not done that and don't look right. Like they're about to.
Yeah, so on that point, so that's the bright spots, Vargas and Chase Mydroth this year offensively for the White Sox. And they are, if you go to Fangraphs right now, they're both above one war, which is not a very high bar, especially when Aaron Judge has already surpassed six war this season. It's going to be hard for the White Sox position players to out-war Aaron Judge, which is pretty sad. But the fact that Vargas and Mydroth has hit one war is good for them. They got a chance to be at least worth two war this upcoming season. But Jim, where there draws a lot of anxiety for me looking ahead for this White Sox team from an analysis standpoint, Luis Robert Jr. and Colson Montgomery not even coming close to meeting expectations. I don't want, maybe catastrophic is too strong of a word, but boy, like Chris Getz's plans coming into the season have blown up. Like, again, to your point earlier, the fact that Robert has been playing so poorly probably has no impact if you trade him on how the team's going to fare win-loss-wise in the second half this season. But it's going to impact the type of players you get back in the trade. Colson Montgomery, reading your latest Farm Fortnite gem, is he even like part of the conversation now? Like, do you realistically still consider him in the long-term plans of the White Sox? Like, what do you do with a guy whose OPS away from Charlotte is below 500, Jim? Like, now there's serious questions in which your star player is not going to bring anything back in return in a trade. And what are we doing at shortstop if Colson Montgomery can't even hit AAA pitching?
Well, I think the second question is easier to answer because Mydroth's playing a decent shortstop.
Right.
So at least that helps in a way that they probably didn't anticipate when they were laying all this track for Montgomery to be the opening day shortstop, if you know, and if not opening day, like first half of the season shortstop. So there's that, and that certainly helps. But yeah, with Montgomery, it's just, it's two seasons in a row like this, and this one's worse than last year, but it's just also been like two seasons or kind of 1.5 years of not being able to trust the White Sox read on Montgomery. Like, it feels like they've been wanting to paper over some of the obvious flaws or the struggles. And it's not easy to talk about, just because, one, you know, it, you know, players do have hot and cold stretches. And so he could have had, you know, just a terrible month and a half to start a season and then flips the switch and he's fine. You know, more last year than this year. And you know, it just doesn't happen. And so, like, you know, there's a certain amount of runway a team's always going to give a top prospect who they believe in before they start, like, you know, setting off alarms themselves. So yeah, at the same time, you know, the way he looked last year didn't scream opening day shortstop. Yeah, you know, it felt like they should have, you know, we talked about over the winter. Unfortunately, Mydroth stepped in and served that purpose, but just, you know, have somebody come in, force Montgomery to earn the job over him. And, you know, that way it's a great thing because you're planning on having Montgomery being the guy anyway, but you don't have to inflate expectations beyond what he showed last year. And, you know, you give him some time in case things don't go right. And, you know, getting off to another, you know, even worse start this time around and just feeling like they're not quite acknowledging it yet. And then they finally did when they sent him to Arizona. And then he comes back and, you know, he's, he has a little bit of a hot stretch and now he's been rough again. And who knows if it's the hit by pitches or just, you know, his physical limitations. But, you know, it feels like they really want to be able to present Montgomery as, you know, the option they always thought he was going to be. And so, you know, while they talk about him and, you know, they're not going to crap on him because he's, you know, just a guy trying to figure it all out. And, you know, if he's working as hard as he can and they feel like his head's in the right place or his heart's right in the right place, they're not going to, you know, air him out in public. But still, it just feels like, you know, you have to look elsewhere for an honest Colson Montgomery appraisal. And right now, everything on the outside saying like he's not a top 100 prospect, like he might be somebody with a steep learning curve if he gets the majors and gets a, you know, starting job. Maybe he's a left fielder, a platoon left field. You know, he kind of, the bar keeps getting lower and lower. And even then, like, it's, you're wondering, like, is he actually gonna clear it? And right now, like, he's not getting any closer to doing so.
Yeah, it's just really discerning. James, have the White Sox said anything lately about Colson Montgomery after Arizona?
I don't know how much he used in the package with Getz, but like, there's a tone of acknowledgement, like, this isn't going well. Okay. I feel like acknowledging, like, he's backsliding to some of the things he went to Arizona for. I think Getz termed it as like, well, he does know what he needs to do mechanically, and it's about doing it. And, you know, I think just in general, and less on the record and more just like talking about it, I think there's a bit more frustration about how it's going, or just like open acknowledgement that it's, you know, not progressing in a way that's ideal. You know, when he gets pulled from a lineup when he's not in the Knights lineup like any given day, and there's like a temptation to like check on, oh, is he getting called up or something in the works, and it's, or is it a day off? And, you know, your responses get a bit more like, come on, have you seen what he's been doing recently? Like, he's not yet hitting this hot streak that would, you know, make it something that's, you know, worth monitoring. So, I mean, he's played almost 180 games at AAA. Like, that's not the trajectory of any like normal top hitting prospect. I think people know where it's at, even if they're not kind of saying it on record in a way that's like acknowledging some adjustment and plan yet.
Okay. So this offseason then, already in the last 81 games, like, there's two big items. One, you got to figure out what you're doing at shortstop. And I'm okay if the White Sox want to continue to see if Chase Mydroth can still be an above average defensive shortstop over the course of the season. You still got Lenin Sosa. He's cheap. He hit two homers on Wednesday, so you can still have him on the roster and move him around. But the other bigger concern that I have, what is going on in the outfield? If you don't keep Luis Robert Jr., you have to get a whole new outfield for 2026, Jim. And other than Brooks Baldwin, is there anyone else worth calling up from AAA to give them playing time in the second half to see if they could be an answer? Because for a team that is strapped for cash to go into the offseason and say, we got to get three or four new outfielders.
They did just last
to
year.
Field a team. Yeah. I know they did last year.
Got them for like $5 million.
But to continue doing that.
They could bring them all back, bizarre. Theoretically. Yeah,
I guess you could.
No, like the only thing I could see is like maybe a position change, but even like Brian Ramos isn't hitting. He might have been the guy who you could fill a platoon role in the outfield. They were kind of already thinking that anyway, but then the spring elbow injury happened, and then he just hasn't really been hitting in the conversation. And one of the funny things about Charlotte, which also makes me concerned about Montgomery, when I was going through the Farm Fortnite and realizing like how many righties Charlotte faces, and like Ramos doesn't hit righties, like he stopped hitting righties a couple of years ago and just hasn't figured it out. And so that's part of the reason why his numbers have been terrible. Like it's insane, like how many righties Charlotte faces. But at the same time, like, wait, why isn't Montgomery hitting then? Like if he's getting right. All righties, like that's, it's, that's it. To circle back to that, it cuts both ways. And so like Brooks Baldwin, that might be part of the reason why he's, doing great if his, he's got his like left hand swing locked in. But it's tricky. And I think, Baldwin, maybe that's why they're so hell bent on him playing the outfield, is because they feel like his infield glove isn't that good to where they need to invest a whole lot of time in it. If they feel like there's more playing time all over the outfield and he might be capable of covering center in a pinch, like that Larry Garcia comparison of just six positions, all of them decent, hit well enough to not be the worst hitter in a lineup on any given day is kind of the bar that I think they're trying to get him to. And I think that's quite a project. But we've talked about Dominic Fletcher just kind of being around and being okay, and the White Sox having lost all interest in him, so there's not that. So yeah, it's pretty tough. Brad Montgomery has, he's doing okay in Winston-Salem, but his trajectory has slowed a little bit, which is fine. You're fine for him. First full season of pro ball, he certainly came out of the gate hot to where you're thinking like, oh, Birmingham by June. But, now I think it's more of a, September call-up next year if he's great. So, that he can't be factored in any plans for 2026, I don't think. So, it's wide open again.
Yay. So let's give our first half grade for the White Sox offense. Their team OPS is 638. That's the worst in Major League Baseball. So I'll just start. My concern on the position player front for the White Sox continues to grow. I'll save some of that thought when we talk about the White Sox front office. But for me, this is a solid F for the White Sox offense in the first half, even though they're on pace to costing me a steak dinner. James, how about you? If you had to give a grade to the White Sox offense, what would you give them?
F plus, D minus. I, given the types of offenses I've witnessed in the past few years, an offense that like doesn't chase and has pretty good zone control, I want to like provide some positive reinforcement for that in some respect. The past week and a half has been a lot of like Will Venable saying like, yeah, we're controlling the zone. It'd be nice to get some of these fastballs we're getting in the zone. And so, like, you see kind of the other side of having a team that's more at-bat quality than, all-flight talent-oriented than previous the groups. And there are, like, if you want, usually from a rebuild perspective, the fact that you have, like, Miguel Vargas is, like, looking like a mainstay. Or Chase Meidroff coming up and getting on base as reliably as you'd want. You'd want to like put more focus on the youth than the older guys when you're kind of given the grade. And that makes me want to like go all the way up to a D. But like when you think about guys you feel like really good about this offense going forward, Vargas, Meidroff, Brady Montgomery, Teal, Caro. Those are all acquired in trade, I believe. I think he'd even go into the farm system and, other than like George Wallkos June, it's usually a bit more like I really like this guy they traded for more than like internal development. And so I think because of that, we do need to weigh pretty heavily that like Vaughn and Robert are looking like they're not going to replenish that stream in any way. I don't know what Aaron Civale can accomplish through transitivity on Vaughn's behalf, but because of that, because that this was supposed to be another year of producing like another big influx, and it's clearly not going to, at least not through this fashion. D half a minus. I don't know what level of like hedging can I still manage to
I'm
accomplish?
just going to put you down for a D minus. I
Okay.
got you down for your D
They
minus.
don't score many runs. It'd
Yeah.
be better if they score more runs. I don't want to be mean to the hitting group because I see progress, but also like they objectively don't score.
Jim, how about you? If you had to give a grade to the White Sox offense, what are you giving?
I would say F as a unit and then like D minus. It feels like a D minus because there are some important hitters who are holding their own. Teo Vargas and Mydroth and even Caro is doing okay. So that feels okay. That's not nothing. But as a unit, like bottom three in basically every meaningful category. So you can't really say that they're not failing. So that's how I kind of parse it to capture both the individual successes and then also just how it's not really amounting to much.
Yeah, because I think it would be fair if we were grading individuals like Miguel Vargas, Chase Mydroth. You're probably giving those guys Bs. And
Right.
for Kyle Teal and Edgar Caro, maybe Cs, with their debut in the major leagues. Everyone else, F. And that's just dragging everything down.
Even talking?
Well, I mean, he can't stay on the field. No, not Talkman. Talkman's been doing really well. So acknowledge Mike Talkman. Thank you for producing some good results to the White Sox offense. But yeah, overall, as a unit, it's a solid F for me. On the pitching side, we were more optimistic about this group when we gave our first quarter grades. And the starter ERA for the White Sox is 4.22. And I know ERA is not everything, but that's 20th in Major League Baseball. The bullpen ERA is now 4.15. A bit surprising. That's good for 19th in Major League Baseball. At home as a pitching staff, the White Sox have a 4 ERA, which is pretty good. Now, the offense is having a terrible time scoring 4 runs per game, not even coming close, really. So it's still producing lukewarm results, having that high of an ERA, but it's getting better. But the question that I have, James, regarding as far as his pitching staff, and I know you've been reporting it on it, and we just got updates on Davis Martin and Jonathan Cannon. But as I mentioned in the intro, the White Sox, as of right now, are a four-man starting staff. And the fifth day, they got to go to a bullpen game where they're really leaning on Mike Vassell to carry three, four, maybe even five innings after an opener. Health-wise, is this rotation going to hold up all year?
Is what they're currently doing holding up? I mean, I feel like they're treading water, so to speak.
Okay. Like survival mode, is that what you're saying? That's where they're in right now?
Right, because they're missing both Martin and Cannon. And, they are basically Mike Vassell's kind of like a piece of the rotation. You get fan questions about, like, why are they not opening for Sean Burke more often? It's like, well, they kind of use an opener once a turn already, just to, as a matter of like survival. I think so. I mean, one, Cannon's rehab start. I mean, my hot take is that like it's probably a possibility for Sunday. So he pitched on Tuesday. They got him up to 60 pitches. He could throw like a 75 pitch outing and kind of come back. They definitely didn't seem like they were set up on two rehab starts. So it could be getting whole pretty quickly. Martin seems like he'll be back by the All-Star break. Or afterwards, be back during the All-Star break would be pointless. There's at least a hair of a possibility of like, not that it's like the greatest long-term use, but if you're really like, oh man, are we gonna straight up run out of starters? Martin Perez still thinks he's gonna pitch this year. So in terms of like getting to the finish line, if everybody's capped out in terms of innings and or being shut down or wearing down or skipping starts, it wouldn't be like the most useless thing to have him back and just fill space. So I Tyler Alexander, you could technically stretch out if you wanted to. I don't know if it'd be pretty. Obviously, just the existence of Clevinger and Syndergaard in the organization kind of feel more like desperation depth additions, but they are things that they've done that they, I don't think anyone would rule out seeing at some point in the second half of the season. Whether it'll be good, a little skeptical because it's been a while since either one were good. But so, yeah, I think they'll find a way to string it together. Will they slip a little bit from their current perch in the middle of the pack? I certainly think losing what the games of Adrian Hauser's life so far would hurt. And I certainly think it's, we could see some strain or Shane Smith kind of regressing has some threat to that since he's been one of the big reasons they've been so good. So I think they could dip a little bit, but I don't know if it, I don't see like, oh my God, they're absolutely going to run out of pitching. Now that can change extremely quickly. We could go from like feeling pretty good to like, Tyler Schweitzer, you need to stretch out again, buddy. Like in a couple of weeks' time, that's how pitching goes. But I'm short of saying disaster. Was I supposed to give a grade? Because like I don't know.
No, not yet. We haven't gotten there yet.
All right, I'm sorry. I take it back. Maybe it'll be a different grade.
Maybe. So let's move over to the bullpen with Grant Taylor there and Brandon Eisert having some strong appearances as well. Jim, are you feeling better about the White Sox bullpen?
Yeah, Taylor is that classic high leverage arm. Yeah, like we talked about last time around, they'll probably make sure that he's not going to be the high leverage guy every time. They're not going to Addison Reed him and have him save six games in a row. But,
it'd be great for fantasy purposes for some teams.
But when he's there, like he's, failure would be a surprise, just because of how good his stuff is and how varied his sequences can be, that he isn't like especially susceptible the way like Michael Kopech was susceptible to anybody could hit a fastball. So that certainly makes a big difference in building a bullpen backwards and feeling like, okay, now Steven Wilson isn't the closer, or Brandon Eisert, although he's still the saves leader, is not the closer necessarily. And Cam Boozer, we'll see what happens to him, but he's no longer like the most interesting high leverage arm they have. So that makes it quite a bit easier. They've been doing a nice job in terms of, I think Mike Vassell's helped a lot in terms of his ability to cover a lot of innings and, spare a reliever. Like he seems to kind of serve the purpose of two pitchers in one, for in terms of like getting across the middle innings of games. So that's cool. They do have a little bit of upside, I think. And when you look at Charlotte bullpens and you see like all the guys who have major league time, like Frazier Eller and Gus Varland, he's coming back and he pitched well last year. You have Peyton Paulette, who's been better since he's made some adjustments to where, you can't rule, seeing him out to where, or you can't rule out seeing him. So yeah, you can, I think, build an effective enough bullpen, Wickelman Gonzalez being around and improving to where it's not as dicey. You should have like an order of, in a game where everybody's rested enough, have an idea of who you're going to get to at the end of the game or in the toughest situation. And the guys you're going to use are people who either have shown they can do it or are worth trying in those situations, to where if they fail, it's like, well, you learn something or they learn something. And perhaps everybody gets better from there.
All right. So I started with the offensive grade last time and James was so eager to dish out his grade. So James, what grade are you giving the White Sox pitching staff after the first half in 2025?
I think I'm going to stick with the C, but it's for like the same kind of non on-field product reason. Like, they haven't cultivated, I mean, they have in sort of Hauser and certainly Savali, there should be a market of sign, but they've managed to cobble together like okay relief work without really developing like a trade asset. Like Brandon Eisert's been effective, but in like the way that like isn't going to like, He'd almost have to pitch the way he had doing for like multiple years in a row, even for teams to buy it. Like a guy who just doesn't have, not only doesn't have like a dominant fastball to lean back on, but like his game is built around avoiding it. Like he's using a changeup a lot. It's been great. He's a really funky angle. It's weird extension. It's got a lot of like weird little outlier things to keep him going. It's not gonna be like, oh, no one's gonna give him like a prospect. Like, oh, we got our eighth inning guy now. Just because like the way Eichstätt stuff profiles just not of that traditional mold. Steven Wilson is like his ERA is good. He's been effective. He's gotten the outs they've asked him to. They haven't quite gotten him up to like, this was a guy who only had a fastball at some point, like a big 97 with like elite ride as a prospect, and then kind of developed a sweeper closer to like being coming to majors. I don't think you've seen the combination of like right now. I don't think you've seen Steven Wilson's best sweeper or his best fastball. But they certainly have never point gotten like both of those working simultaneously, where it's like not only is he getting outs for this team, but he's got these weapons that we evaluate and covet. We're going to give you value for it. Like, I think any team could add Steven Wilson, feel like, hey, we got a big league reliever. We can trust him to do some things. He's worked leverage before, but I don't think it's like this is the big weapon. We got to have this since this is going to be a big piece. I think it goes down the board. Like someone whose ingredients kind of most look like the reliever you add would probably be Jordan Leisure. And when he looks right, he looks really good, but like hasn't had that level of consistency or run prevention to really, he's been a little homer prone for in ways that make me wonder if he's just cursed because they're often on like perfectly executed fastballs. But just no one's quite at that level. And like the piece, like obviously you don't want to trade Grant Taylor for trade assets at the deadline or Wilkham and Gonzalez. So there's reasons to feel good about their bullpen, but it's more about like, hey, these young guys could help. And hey, this guy has been serviceable and useful and got them through some games. But like some of your bigger disappointments are, someone who looks the type more like Cam Boozer, who has had these blow up outings and is now on the shelf a little bit. And, especially from a control standpoint, you probably are more of like, let's try again next year and see if he's in a better spot at this point. So, in terms of like making watchable baseball and some of the developments have, and certainly finding Shane Smith and what he's been able to do, I'm tempted to like give developmental thumbs up that rank higher than a C. But in terms of what's really been the main infusion of the system, and certainly with draft in 10th and the international operations still getting off the ground, it feels like trades is probably still their was supposed to be their better route for getting impact, prospect depth that's closer to the majors and closer to making this like a watchable product on a regular basis. And I don't feel like they've done great at that, even if that's mostly like happenstance luck reasons than anything else. And also they obviously didn't spend very much on like name
No.
brand relievers, even the way they did last year. Like I think you could probably at the start of last season think like, oh, I could see us flipping Tim Hill and John Brebbia. They've been reliable relievers before. And I don't think they even made that level of kind of investments to flip around. They got all these weird guys who get outs in fringy ways, and it's not necessarily surprising that they're not, obvious trade assets now after 3 months in Chicago.
Jim, how about you? What grade are you giving the pitching staff?
I feel like a C minus. They're, kind of below average in a lot of ways. Walks and hit batters, they're towards the bottom. You're not striking out a ton of guys, so it all feels very tenuous, as watchable as they've been. But I think, some of the successes are maybe more on, later conversations about, managing, problem solving, et cetera. When you look at upside and you look at how good you feel about like Jonathan Cannon, is he going to be good for the rest of the season? Davis Martin, is he going to come back from his elbow issue? Okay. Shane Smith, is he going to last the entire year? Are they going to have to give him breathers at some point? Same thing as Sean Burke. Like nobody feels that stable yet to give higher than a C minus, or at least like give bonus points for feeling, oh, they got their fixtures. But there are enough decent performances to where, it doesn't feel like, I wouldn't consider a D. I'm basically, going between C and C minus versus like C minus and D plus. So I feel like they're
Okay.
watchable, professional, And, given the standards of recent White Sox play, that's fine. But yeah, it does feel like they both need to up their performance. And, losing an entire level of depth with Thorpe and Bush and Adams and Krell and everything like that just being eradicated for the season, yeah, it all feels still very dicey. And I think if they were around to patch more holes and plug guys in and out and get breathers, etc., that it probably would feel a little bit more sturdy than it does right now.
I'm going to give the White Sox pitching staff a C. They're on pace to only allow 724 runs this year. That's an 89 runs allowed decrease from last year, where they gave up 813 runs. So we're seeing significant improvement from the White Sox pitching staff and the run allowance prevention group. So good job on that front for the White Sox, where, yeah, on the offense, I'm really concerned about pitching. I'm hopeful because the team's doing such a good job in developing the arms that they do have. I'm excited what they can do when they have better premium arm talent to work with. Which brings us to the coaching staff. This is the first half of Will Venable's coaching career. Jim, what are your early thoughts about Will Venable as manager?
Well, I think to kind of follow up on what I was hinting at was that I think he's done a nice job of solving problems or showing flexibility on the pitching side. When watching the Tigers last year after trading Jack Flaherty and still managing to stitch together very useful pitching performances from regular starters and then openers and everything else, that's really what I wanted to see from the next White Sox manager is just that open-mindedness and the ability to, throw stuff against the wall and, do what other teams are doing and not feel like it's a huge sacrifice or a big ask or anything crazy. And he's been very calm about a lot of improvising he's been able to do. So I like that part of it. When you look at some of the underhood stuff defensively, Baseball Info Solutions really grading well for positioning, like both shifts wise, outfield alignment wise. They're plus a lot of the they're still below average defensively on the whole, but like it's not because of where they're standing. It's I think it's more who they're playing, and in case of like Josh Rojas not being good at third base, which is kind of around like setbacks here and there. But in terms of what the coaching staff can provide, and help them with, like it's showing up in that regard. I would say, like, if I had to pick nits or areas for improvement, we've seen, with a few veterans, just the random guy who was never in the plan suddenly getting a lot of playing time and being in the middle of things, like whether it's Joshua Palacios or Vinny Capper, like Ryan Noda is the latest guy. Like, why is he playing so much? That kind of confused me. Not a huge fan of playing the infield in so early. It does feel like a little bit of he considers it pressure and being aggressive. To me, it strikes me as more desperate. And like they can't overcome a 2-run deficit in the first inning. But yeah, when you factor in like the pluses and the minuses, I would say like the positives of just the what seems like more effective information and more flexibility in the pitching side definitely offsets just the strange journeyman preference that he shows from time to time.
Do you get that same feeling as well, James, getting to cover Venable almost every single day, and compared to your experiences chatting and try to understand Pedro Grifol's thought processes the last couple of seasons?
Do I feel the same as in
Do
terms
you
of?
feel, does it feel more like there's more clarity in the decision-making process from Will Venable's coaching staff than previous years?
I feel it's more systemized.
Okay.
Like in terms of like Jim talking about them pulling the infield in, like it is desperate, so to speak. It's also like automatic. Like it's not like he does it every time making a decision about how he feels about the offense. Like they just have like our math tells us it's the best idea to just do it whenever, so we do it. And I think a lot of their decisions are of that, like, this is what we do level of decisiveness, and this is just like our system, which I think provides a clarity to his decision making that obviously feels refreshing to like, well, how do I kind of get Tony to explain this post game without him blowing up at us? Level of mystery, where it's a lot more ad hoc, bespoke. Like the White Sox have a way of doing things under Will Venable. Like they basically like it is all geared around the idea of like we don't think we can hit, and so that's like no run should ever be conceded, and every real opportunity with any leverage to get the platoon advantage, especially for hitters who are kind of already designated to only operate in platoon situations, we're just going to do it, and we're going to run out of subs. If that happens, it happens. Like we're not going to hold off on the move that can get us there for some kind of theoretical thing we're worried about. They would never not use their closer in the ninth inning of a tie game on the road, I don't think. That game in Texas, they lost in extra innings. Kind of was like, I don't know. It very much was emblematic of like the Will Venable managerial experience. Like he, if you've been watching him all season, not only did he press every button in every situation and kind of offered it that based on the way he's been managing the team. Like if you've been watching the season all along pretty closely, like, you know, someone's paying you to do it. Thank you, subscribers. You could probably have guessed all the moves he was going to make. Other than just like, hey, I think they're out of dudes. I don't think we spend a lot of time in the press box like debating like, well, who are they going to sub in now? Because you can kind of see their organization like working, you know, pretty automized. And so like, yeah, I think there are gaps in having that sort of systematic approach. Certainly the guy who's like playing blackjack and just has like hits on 18 every time, you're going to see him like look stupid. But there's it seems like it frees them up to pay attention to other things that they have these things that they're kind of the way team functions. And I think it probably makes it a little bit less frictiony with subbing players out that much that they just know like that's how they're going to be used. So I want to give him a very high grade because the
Well,
highest I can
we're not gonna grade him for the first half because
without looking like a suck up, but like I generally feel better about probably Venable leading the coaching staff part of the operation going forward than I feel about the they're going to acquire the right players part of the operation going forward. I think that side is a bit more to prove. Whereas Venable seems like this seems like perfectly suitable for a modern organization. Like he's going to frustrate you by being like too rigidly analytic than otherwise. And while I've certainly seen plenty of counterexamples, I would think if you're a White Sox fan, you'd be willing to err on that side, if only to experience the other side of the fence for once in your life.
I don't think, what surprises me, I'm trying to think, has he gone 81 games without stepping in it yet?
Unless you count Tyler Alexander having to hit for himself, stepping in it. Like in terms of like post game pictures.
Well, in terms of like just either, real confusing sequence, I mean, that happened, but like you said, he pressed every single, but part of the reason why Alexander hit was because like his moves earlier worked. And so it's a case of, he painted himself in the corner by being aggressive early, but in terms of just how he presents ideas, how he responds to questions, how he explains processes, just even like he seems like he's we've seen him be pointed in terms of being critical of some players or identifying where they can improve either individually or as a unit, but not in a way that feels like doghousing anybody. So it does feel like for a team that's as bad as they are, perhaps it's a case of just because now you have last year to know how bad things can be and they're not that bad. Perhaps he benefits from being graded on Pedro Grifol's curve as to where it's just he passes, he's not creating his own problems, but to me, I'm trying to think like there hasn't really been any kind of media moments to where you think like, oh, this guy is, we sure about this guy? Whereas like Grifol, it didn't take that long to be like, this guy is not the guy you want as the front-facing person in the organization twice a day for 162 games.
He said, "I don't know," in response to a couple questions, but usually in ways that clearly indicate I have deferred this responsibility to someone else, and they did the research behind it, and I just said, "Oh, I gave my signature," and I don't like. I asked him the other day, like, why he likes Talkman in front of Madroth. Like, they obviously both are on base guys. Like, being up in the lineup doesn't stir you, but like, what particularly reason is like one in front of the other? Like, because one has like a bit more power. Do you like that because he can potentially knock in the bottom of the order? Or that, if Talkman has extra bases, like Mydroth is in an RBI situation just with a single, whereas maybe driving Mydroth in from first every single time is a bit hard, more of a process. And he's just like, yeah, those are all interesting observations. I don't really know. Our process kind of spit that out. And she's like, oh, okay. That
So if this never gets better,
was kind of
and
the
to
same answer for like Palacios, like kidding. He was just like,
yeah.
yeah. Objectively, he just always comes out as one of our top five options against right-handed hitters. So we wind up batting him pretty high every time we face a righty. And it wasn't like, oh, I really like him. Something about his swings like really speak to me, or I think he really. I've been watching him against this guy. I think he matches up. He's like, yeah, numbers spit it out. Slap the formula when we put the guy in the lineup. Like it wasn't. It was
Okay.
almost like it didn't like say like this is Bill Venable making this call and it's going to work. But it was a bit more like, hey, I turned the machine on and this is what it came out.
Yeah, I
Here we
guess it's refreshing to hear. I don't know, or not trying to pretend you have the answer or that you have like a lot of thought, which I think was a big part of Grifols' problem, was just a very self-conscious needing to prove that he's the guy in charge or that he's got the he's the one making decisions and he's thought it through. I guess this is something that might be tested in games that actually counts. You probably want a little more conviction in decisions at some points. But at that point, probably he knows that if the White Sox are competing and he's not getting 53 players rostered on him in a half, there's probably, I would hope he would have a better sense of guys to where maybe he doesn't say I don't know, or they're just because they're only using 15 position players in a half. He's got more than just what the metrics say about a guy to feel like he's a better option, or just that the nine starters are a better option than their bench players. Like there's a clearly defined line between the regulars and the bench players, which right now there is not. So it's worth watching. But yeah, I've noticed the I don't know, and I thought, well, that's kind of refreshing, that there isn't a he's not pretending.
He says like, I don't. Venable says I don't know why Palacios is batting fifth in Game Six of the World Series. Like that would be a different like.
A problem.
Let's follow up on that a bit more.
We haven't heard observational analytics. So I guess in what I was trying to get at a minute ago, if this doesn't get better in 2 to 3 years, it's probably the system that's not good, it sounds like, rather than Will Venable's scouting ability or going to back to LaRussa's observational analytics and only leaning on that. If the White Sox are still struggling with lineup construction and optimizing offensive production, we can point to the system that they are using could use some upgrades compared to Will Venable's baseball acumen, which we had to judge Pedro Grifols' baseball acumen a lot last year. But then to recap, as far as the first half grades, or to finish on this point, the White Sox front office. And I think a lot of the things we talked about giving grades, what the White Sox front office has done well, when you consider Chris Getz and even Brian Bannister, being able to find patchwork solutions on the pitching front. I know you wrote about it, Jim, like Shane Smith Rule 5 pick to get this level of production is phenomenal. Mike Vassell is giving you better than expected production as a Rule 5 pick, even out of the bullpen. So to find those two guys at the Rule 5, you definitely deserve a pat on the back. To take a risk on Adrian Hauser, and that's working this well. And then trading Andrew Vaughn, which you had no use for anymore, to get Aaron Civale to help on the starting rotation, I feel like that's a good move as well. And the White Sox are doing well on the margins. I think Chris Getz is doing a better job than Rick Hahn in finding those type of solutions. But the problem that I have is the big picture, where that's where Rick Hahn and Kenny Williams in the last regime, they kept pounding the table, but in a way they should have, because it's like, yeah, we know who's in our starting lineup. It's going to be Jose Abreu. It's going to be Yoan Moncada and Eloy Jimenez and Luis Robert and Tim Anderson. Like, they had that part figured out, and who is their core? We don't know. And the minor leagues, we talked about on the offense, no one's really stepping up to give that assurance that a new position player core is being built. So I know James was hinting at, like, a lot of these guys they've acquired recently are by trades. They're not getting a lot back in the draft front. And this is what, Jim, we've been podcasting. This is our 12th season. This is the fourth draft director.
So I think Lauman was probably the first one.
Lauman, Hostetler. Oh, it's the third. Shirley took over for Hostetler. So as long as we've been podcasting, it's been three draft directors. And I feel like if Shirley can't execute on this draft and you're still not getting better results, do you really want him to be making the number one pick for you? Do you want him to be leading that effort? I have a ton of questions on the position player front. And I don't want to point the finger at Ryan Fuller because he just got here. He needs more time to start getting results. But I feel like, Jim, the grace period is going to be expiring for Chris Getz and Josh Barfield and Gene Watson, all these guys that they brought in to try to address the position player front. You need to start coming up with answers. You need to start having a better game plan coming into this offseason. Because if you don't fix this part, this is going to feel a lot like the 2013-2015 Chicago White Sox, Jim, where they can pitch, but they can't hit.
Yeah, it's tricky when it comes to, like, I think part of the problem is when he gets a good veteran, he trades him. So it's a case
well,
of
he has
like
no choice right now.
Yeah, but it's a case of, like, sometimes he has signings that work, but they just don't amount to much because, like, they're just churn. You know, they're part of the whole turnover process. So, you know, when you look at, like, say, like Matt Theis being a pretty nifty move, and even like Corey Lee's been fine. And then, you know, getting two more catchers, like, he's great at acquiring catchers. If he could acquire any other position the way he could acquire catchers, like, they'd be in great shape. But right now he's nailed all four of his catcher acquisitions relative to what they cost. And, now it's, you know, extending it to the rest of the lineups, tougher, you know, to your point about the pitching staff, like, I think one advantage is that he's a lot more transactional than Rick Hahn was.
Yes.
And so part of it's desperation, but even like some Rick Hahn's teams are desperate and they just didn't move much. And so, you know, we're seeing this interesting jobs program to where, like, he just takes players off AAA rosters and gives them guaranteed money. And that's kind of a sad reflection of where they are, but also it's creative. It's using what you have is playing time and roster spots and run to make something happen. And so that's kind of cool. Like, even like getting a, you know, someone like Syndergaard, you know, as unpopular as it is, like, he's just trying different things and to get through a season. So you're seeing like that kind of you know, creativity, or at least open-mindedness, like not getting stuck on the guys who should have produced or his plan A's and just, you know, going through it. So that's cool. But yeah, it's at some point, you know, he needs to acquire players with the idea that they're going to be around for a while. For a full year would be around for a while. And that's where it gets tougher to really judge, you know, the way he can amass talents. It would be nice for them to have expectations to where, like, if Mike Tauchman's having a good season, you're like, great. Let's see him carry this all the way through. Let's give him a better right-handed caddy for right field versus, oh, when can you trade him in May? Like, that's, I think, the really tough part. And it makes it really hard to contextualize just how much his moves matter. And yeah, so I think, you know, one way or another, he's got to get this roster in shape where his moves matter.
Do you feel the same way, James? Is there a lot more pressure? The international front's being rebooted. I know that's part of the long-term plan, so it's going to be a few years before seeing any results there, but it feels like they got to nail this draft, or that sweet, sweet Justin Ishbia money needs to be a large amount coming into this offseason. And I don't even know.
I wouldn't bank on that.
No, I wouldn't either. So it's like, it does raise the question, though, and it's a legit one. And I'm sure it's very tough for Chris Getz to answer. Like, Chris, how is this team going to get a lot better? And by a lot better, I mean, instead of talking about a 50-win team, we're talking about a 70, 75-win team in 2026.
I don't know if you're secretly tricking me into doing native advertising for your draft coverage, but yes, it is of immense importance.
I wouldn't do such a thing. Come on.
They need to, like, even not getting, like, as good of a player as, you know, you would if you got what a 120 loss season usually gets you in draft pick order. They need to land a star in this draft. Like, this is kind of the window to draft high or have big pools. And, you know, this is a time to really, knowing where the international system is, knowing that you've kind of exhausted a lot of your resources, certainly from the last, like, you know, contending team, as far as like trade pieces, like that is where it comes through at this point. And I think they've gone through enough to know there are limits to what they can get hitting wise in the trade market. Like, it's certainly a higher exchange rate, it seems, at that point. So obviously, if they hit on Hagen Smith, and, you know, to all the people who get itchy or want to analyze the development of a pitching prospect after less than a year since drafting him, it's not, certainly for this team most of all, it's not about like speed of development track. It's what Smith ends up into, and, you know, certainly they have reason to feel confident about, you know, their ability to turn around that profile. But yeah, as far as like, there's not, Brady Montgomery could be it, but like, otherwise there's not really like a bat to build around in this organization. And ideally, even if Brady Montgomery is that, you would have multiple. So yes, the draft is very important. Follow Josh Nelson, who I believe could speak more to how deep the bats are, to whether there's real opportunity of landing star level talent after the first round. But that is kind of their main avenue going forward. One window is kind of closing and the other one hasn't opened up yet as far as like funneling talent in. So that's the one that's kind of constant.
Tough spot. It's a real tough spot to be in. I wish the draft team the best of luck. And again, as of right now, if the season were to end today and you have the draft lottery, the White Sox would have a really good chance of having a top three pick in next year's draft. There's some promising college bats that they can maybe dream on to be one of those star players, especially to help out at the shortstop position. But that's next summer. So yeah, they still got to figure out answers now.
I would hope to have less griping this time around about like NIL money and how expensive players are.
If he like starts there, I don't know what to say to him. Be like, you're in the wrong spot, Mike. Wrong job. If you're going to start, if this is this scouting draft director, if you're going to, for back to back years, Jim, to your point, complain about NIL money and we missed out guys because they're taking that sweet, sweet NIL money to go play in the SEC, you're in the wrong gig. It's time to go find a scouting director that can negotiate with agents a lot better than the one that I've got. So
emotions are high at that time of year.
No, I get it. I understand, but everyone's protecting their selves, right? And that's the other thing too. Like, if Ishbia were to give Chris Getz $100 million, could Ishbia trust Chris Getz that he could spend it wisely? We don't know that answer because Getz hasn't even had coming anywhere close to having that type of money to spend. Whereas Rick Hahn and Kenny Williams went hog wild on the bullpen and Andrew Benintendi not suffering the ramifications of that spending at all. It's an important draft. It's a tough
spot. I think
spot.
Every White Sox Zoom presser should veer into a different societal ill. Like, if we hadn't cut the funding for public libraries, these players would X da da da.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let us know what your guys' thoughts are on our grades and what your grades are for the White Sox first half and the things that you're going to be paying attention to going into the second half of this season. For the White Sox, starting the second half, they'll be at home. This weekend, they'll be facing the San Francisco Giants. I'll be away on vacation, so I'll be reading Jim and James's work all weekend long, as you could be reading the game recaps on SoxMachine.com and follow us on social media. Offensively, I'm sorry, for the win-loss record for the San Francisco Giants, as we're recording this, they're currently playing the Miami Marlins. So the Giants were 44-35 before Wednesday night. In their last 10, they are 4-6. Offensively for the Giants, big bat, of course, we talked about it. Rafael Devers has joined the San Francisco Giants lineup. Runs per game this year, 4.23 runs a game. Team OPS, not that great. 686, that's 24th in Major League Baseball. On the road, they're actually hitting worse on the road than they are in San Francisco. A bit of a surprise. Their road OPS is 680. They've hit 77 home runs as a team. That's good for 23rd in Major League Baseball. So not a scary offense like Arizona was. On the pitching side, the starter ERA for the Giants is 3.72. That's good for 12th in Major League Baseball. The bullpen has an ERA of 2.63. That is the best in Major League Baseball. So late game situations, the White Sox could have some tough at-bats against the Giants relievers. On the road this year, the Giants ERA is 3.72. That's good for 7th in Major League Baseball. So another strong pitching staff the White Sox will be facing this weekend. Your pitching problems for this series, Friday night at 6:40 p.m. Central Time. This is the Flo Rida post-game concert game. We'll see if it actually happens, the concert itself. Aaron Civale will take the ball for the White Sox against righty Landon Roop for the Giants. Saturday afternoon, 3:10 p.m. Central Time, it's Adrian Hauser against Robbie Ray. Robbie Ray's having a good year for the Giants. His ERA is 2.83. And then on Sunday at 1:10 p.m. Central Time, as James mentioned earlier in the show, this could be Jonathan Cannon. It could be another bullpen game. But Justin Verlander will take the ball for the San Francisco Giants. Verlander has yet to win a game this year. He's 0-5 with a 4.52 ERA as he's entering the twilight of his career, or at least the end of his career. James, what are you looking forward to as far as covering this weekend series between the White Sox and the Giants?
One, possibly the return of Jonathan Cannon. If like Davis Martin and Hayden Birdsong like compare their kick changes in some way, I guess, because one's not scheduled to pitch, the other one is hurt. There's probably limits to them going against each other, but maybe one day, like them being on the face each other would be interesting. They don't necessarily have, I mean, lefties have been their issue, or if not like their issue in terms of results, it's kind of like the big bad that all their pitchers are kind of working around. Like Sean Burkney, they had to change up deals lefties. He had the opener lefties. Cannon and kind of a similar boat, really needed to remove his changeup. So lefty slug was like a big issue for him last year and early part of this year. Martin kind of similar. That's why the kick change is necessary. Adrian Hauser being a sinker baller is, you know, traditionally not a great profile against lefties. They just don't have a lot of weapons to be like, man, I bet that guy feels confident against Rafi Devers. So yeah, the Giants are not a great offense, but we haven't necessarily gotten a big sample of what they look like with Devers and how much that powers them up. And I just feel like lefty bat ones, Rick Fields is like very friendly for lefty bats, which I think Benintendi's, you know, late career shift towards being a power hitter kind of indicates. And I, as much as I feel like they've probably performed a bit more than they were worried about against lefties overall, I haven't checked the numbers. That is kind of the profile I feel a little vulnerable against. So,
okay.
Does Rafi Devers have some insane five homer weekend? That's maybe something I'm a little watching out for or worried about. Also just, you know, as someone who Verlander dates back to when I was unabashedly just a White Sox fan and thus hated his guts. So to see him like the old lion in winter will be interesting from seeing your tormentor now withered and ragged is a weird coming of age experience.
No, that's true. How about you, Jim? What are you paying attention to this weekend?
Yeah, Verlander jumped out to me. I saw that he set the Giants record for most starts To start a season without a win with 12, and that struck me as like a little bit low for, you know, the Giants are not a young franchise, not among the older franchises, but a young one for San Francisco. But yeah, I looked at the White Sox and like, yeah, Dylan Covey had 12 in his year. Dan Wright had 15 during his cursed season during fifth starter hell. So, you know, talking about remembering some guys, I guess Danny Wright would be our Mike Caruso for this time around. Also, Dutch Henry, all-time leader, 1930, went 16 games at the start of the season, starting without getting a win. So that's your White Sox trivia for the moment. But yeah, that's interesting. Devers has been dealing with a groin issue that's not keeping him out of the lineup, but is preventing him from playing first base. And I guess he's not running all that well, or like it's visible. So maybe the White Sox are catching him in a good time. But yeah, just it's a matter of, you know, when it comes to the second half and this whole idea of them winning more games than they did in the first half, they do have to win some games you wouldn't expect them to win while they still have all their talent on hand before they trade Hauser or Savali or Talkman or everybody else. So they'll have to come up with some surprising series. Like this series against Diamondbacks was kind of like the quintessential 54-1 team, like winning one, losing two, losing one ugly, losing one that was just shooting themselves in the foot, and then you know, winning one. Like that's kind of the starter pack for any bad team, is that kind of series that they just had. So in order to upend expectations, or at least your expectations for the second half, like they're gonna have to just surprise a team once in a while. So looks like they're set up well enough in terms of who's healthy and you know, who the Giants have, you know, like they're that to where like I would expect one, two out of three, but they would have enough going for them entering the series to where like, yeah, if they did it, they might surprise them like they did the Blue Jays.
Hmm. Well, maybe if they went on Friday, it'd be a big celebration, because I know James is stoked and he is ready to go to get his stance on for the Flo Rida post-game concert. He and John Triffin are going to party it up.
You know, people are actually believe you that I'll have to deal with as a result of this.
Good.
John Triffin's going to be like doing the Hawk Harrelson. I'm leaving the booth early to get down the field.
I hope there's a media availability for Flo Rida. And I expect you to be there.
It's Flo Rida. Ryder sounds like you're from Massachusetts or something. Like that's a Jerry Remy pronunciation.
Yeah, I guess. I'm shocked that he's even showing up, to be honest with you. I'm looking at the weather. Maybe he won't with the way things have gone with the post-game concerts for the White Sox as of late.
The country one went off, right? That was
no, it rained out.
Oh, rained out, okay.
Yeah,
that one wasn't like a national humiliation.
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. That's the goal. That's the bar. Yeah. That's not a no bad PR. There's been enough bad PR for White Sox fans this week.
Oh, but they drew well, right? They drew well and then canceled the. Was that the one? Was that the snag?
Yeah, Vanilla Ice. Yeah.
No. I'm talking about the. Was it Jordan? They all have the same names to me. But was it Jordan?
You live in Nashville. How do you know?
They still have
this?
All the same name. They're all. You know, you can switch them back and forth. They're all first names. They're all Anglo-Saxon in nature. Like, yeah, basically, like, they're all Corbin Easton, Easton Corbin, Jordan Owen, Owen Jordan. Like, you can just flip them back and forth, and it's all the same. But didn't they draw well for that one, and then it got canceled, and a bunch of people were pissed?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, okay, so it's coming back to me.
Yeah, well, we'll see if it happens. But if you do go to the post-game concert, let us know. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. I hope you guys have a wonderful weekend. I will be back on Sunday night to record a new episode. So we'll have that ready to go for you guys on Monday as I head on a mini vacation. If you've ever been to Bozeman, Montana, hit me up. Give me some suggestions on what to do as I'll be there for a few days. But thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. If you subscribe to the show, you can subscribe through Spotify and Apple Music, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also listen and watch our videos on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. You can follow James at JRFegan for breaking White Sox news, if we do get any, especially with Luis Robert's injury before this weekend series against the San Francisco Giants. We're also on Blue Sky. You can follow us. We're at Sox Machine. You can follow James at JRFegan.SoxMachine.com. You can follow me, Josh.SoxMachine.com. If you enjoy our work and want full access of all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox, Major League Baseball, and the upcoming Major League Baseball draft, you can unlock that access and also the comment section by signing up to become a Sox Machine subscriber at SoxMachine.com. Monthly plans start at $5. We also have annual discounts as well. We have a couple spots open in our Veterans Committee, so if you want to be part of the group chat and have direct access to both Jim and James, especially with the upcoming trade deadline as well, you can inquire within. Again, sign up at SoxMachine.com. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, your home for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Feegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.